This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. Topping our Week in Review today, the special election race for the U.S. Senate, which began to take shape this week.
Among the Democrats, a new WBUR poll gives Congressman Ed Markey the edge over fellow Democrat Stephen Lynch, but only a slight edge.
Right now, Steve Lynch actually does slightly better. I mean, within the margin of error, but slightly better among unenrolled voters.
And on the Republican side, a scramble to fill the void left by former Senator Scott Brown.
I'm not a politician, so I'll have a very different kind of campaign. If you're happy with the way things are going in our government, I'm not your kind of candidate.
And speaking of Scott Brown, Fox News introduced its newscast contributor.
Former Massachusetts Senator, now Fox News contributor Scott Brown. Welcome, Senator. How are you?
Hey, Sean, great to be on, and hello to you and your viewers.
Also this week, a strange and surprising twist in the case against reputed mobster James Whitey Bulger.
James Bulger was never an informant to the FBI or anybody else at any time.
Coming soon to a courthouse near you, the trial of the century.
And of course, the week began with snow, lots of snow, and a big effort to clean it all up, but not big enough to please Mayor Tom Menino.
You're taking too long, and I want to make sure the next time we have a snowstorm in the city of Boston, it doesn't take that long.
So those are some of the stories we'll dig into with two members of our regular Week in Review team. John Carroll, professor of journalism at BU and author of the blogs It's Good to Live in a TwoDailyTown.com and CampaignOutsider.com. Welcome back, John. Always good to have you.
Always good to be here.
And Dante Ramos, deputy editorial page editor at the Boston Globe. Welcome back, Dante. Good to have you.
Great to be here. Thank you.
So let's begin with that new WBUR poll on the special election for the U.S. Senate. It finds a fairly competitive race between Congressman Ed Markey of Malden and Steve Lynch of South Boston. Among likely Democratic voters, Markey leads Lynch by 8 points. But the race for the Democratic nomination could be a lot closer depending upon what those all-important unenrolled voters do, whether they decide to cast ballots in the Republican primary or the Democratic primary. Here's Steve Cozzella of Mass Inc. Polling Group, who conducted our poll.
Well, one of the interesting things about the Democratic primary is it could actually be affected by the Republican primary. Where unenrolled voters vote on primary day actually will affect the Democratic primary. Right now, Steve Lynch actually does slightly better, I mean, within the margin of error, but slightly better among unenrolled voters, and much better than he does among registered Democrats, where Markey actually has a pretty significant lead.
So the more independent voters Lynch can draw into the Democratic primary, the better his chances are. John, what do you find interesting about this poll? What jumps out at you?
Well, beyond the unenrolled is the undecided, and I think that that's an interesting sort of block of voters. Can you get them to choose one of these candidates? Can you get them to turn out? I think that's going to be one of the determinants. It's a really short race, and so I think it's going to be hard. And I've been looking around to see, you know, signs of life in terms of social media, websites, that kind of thing, and it's all very slapdash right now. Mm. It's very scattered, very slapdash, and I think we were used to sort of the machine-type campaign, the campaigns of Scott Brown and Elizabeth Warren most recently, and I think that this one's shaping up as off to kind of a stumbling start.
So undecided voters, big opportunities for both and big numbers. The primary is just in 2 months. Our poll found that 20% of those polled had never heard of Lynch, 25% never heard of Markey. Dante Ramos, what jumps out at you? What did you find interesting in this poll?
Well, to piggyback on John's point, you know, it's striking how, you know, people who are in the media or who are in political circles probably feel like they have a pretty good sense of who Stephen Lynch and Ed Markey are. The poll makes it clear that, you know, a lot of people in the electorate don't feel the same way and probably have a surface familiarity with them as, you know, longtime members of Congress. But, you know, the distinction that a lot of kind of political junkies would see is Lynch as being the more blue-collar, more union-oriented, more, you know, more conservative candidate, and Markey as being the more progressive and environmentally minded candidate. I don't think that those distinctions have been drawn yet. They'll become sharper over the course of the campaign. But you know, the fact that the fact that the that that Lynch got into the race becomes more evident from the poll, too. I mean, it's clear that Markey was the strong favorite of the party apparatus, so to speak. But, you know, Lynch clearly, in the lack of definition, saw an opportunity.
Mm. On the issues, improving the economy and jobs, that rated the most important issue among those polled, followed closely by controlling the cost of health care. Perhaps not super surprising, but do those issues offer any insight into which candidate might be better positioned with the voters, John?
Well, I believe that Stephen Lynch voted against Obamacare, so I think that may actually work to his advantage if there's a real concern about Obamacare raising the price of health care, the cost of health care. I also think that there's an opportunity for Lynch in terms of positioning himself as somebody who is not in lockstep with the Democratic establishment. I think that hurt Martha Coakley in the special election against Scott Brown, and I think that's a label that can be pinned on Ed Markey as well. And I think whoever the Republican candidate is going to say, do you really want another a 10th Democratic vote down there, somebody who votes in lockstep with the party establishment as opposed to an independent voice? It worked for Scott Brown, and I can't imagine that the Republican candidate won't use the same gambit again.
Yeah, what do you think, Dante?
Well, I think that the dynamics or the emotional dynamics of this race could go either way. You know, in 2012, you saw a very strong very pro-Democratic incumbent kind of voter mood. In 2010, both in the Scott Brown election, the special election, and in the fall nationwide, you saw more voter anger-oriented voter movement, and obviously, you know, if there's more of a voter anger movement when the special election comes around, that's something that will work to Stephen Lynch's advantage. If there's more of a tolerance for the establishment or a feeling among Democratic voters in the state that the general direction of the party is the right one, it's probably going to go Markey's way.
Mm. Well, the poll also found that the Republican candidates have their work cut out for them. It found that most people don't know anything about them. So let's talk a bit about that side of the race. As we know, Representative Dan Winslow from Norfolk is running. And this week, Gabriel Gomez, a former Navy SEAL and private equity investor from Cohasset, jumped into the race. Here's a clip from his campaign video.
I'm not a politician, so I'll have a very different kind of campaign. If you're happy with the way things are going in our government, I'm not your kind of candidate. Washington bickers and fights over everything. It's too partisan, it's too petty, and too little gets done. People say it can't be changed. As a Navy SEAL and now a businessman in Boston, I've been doing things that people said couldn't get done.
And here's Republican State Representative Dan Winslow on WBZ yesterday touting his bipartisan credentials. Let's listen.
My approach, quite candidly, will be much more independent. You know, I have been willing to work across the aisle in fact as well as in statements. And a 55% record of working with Democrats in Massachusetts is something that I'm very proud of.
So we know that Sean Bilad, who has twice run for Congress, has filed paper and has seriously considered getting into the race, as well as former U.S. Attorney Michael Sullivan, who's trying to gather the necessary signatures on his own. John, how do you see the Republican side of this race for the Senate shaping up?
Well, it was really interesting because earlier in the week, the GOP, the state party apparatchiks, were talking about the Scott Brown factor, which I know sounds like a 60s British invasion band, but it's actually a theory that the more obscure the candidate, the better. So they were saying, you know, we've played right into our hands. We're sitting pretty here because we got two people who nobody knows. Michael Sullivan sort of mixes that up a little bit. But I think that, they're going to be throwing a Hail Mary pass for the next 5-6 weeks. I mean, they have no reasonable expectation that either one of these candidates can take off. Mm. It might happen. Anything can happen. I mean, you know, Scott Brown came out of nowhere, too. But I think that they would love to have somebody who has a little more heft. They're trying to just make the best of a bad situation at this point.
Yeah, Dante Ramos, do you agree with that? I mean, there's a lot of talk about this sort of wilderness, the political wilderness that the Republicans are sort of trying to find their way out of. Does this race offer sort of a route out for them, I guess?
Well, you know, the political wilderness feels like it's the description of Massachusetts Republicans in every single election. What's interesting to me about this situation is the gravity that Scott Brown's election the first time around still exerts on this race. You know, if you remember when in the race to succeed Ted Kennedy, it's not as though Scott Brown had to claw his way past a lot of other Republicans. You know, it was seen as him doing the party a favor in getting into the race to begin with, and that he was just positioning himself to run for something else. And, you know, obviously the long odds of victory are something that has kept Brown and maybe some other Republicans out of this race. At the same time, you know, the fact that Brown won makes other Republicans, somebody like Gomez, somebody like Winslow, think that, well, there's some kind of crapshoot Hail Mary scenario where they could really win. So, you know, I think that somebody like Dan Winslow is as well known statewide as Scott Brown was 3 years ago. You know, Mr. Gomez, I think, is less well known, but seems willing to put a lot of money down on his own candidacy. So, you know, I don't think it's they're any worse off than they were when Scott Brown was elected.
And speaking of Scott Brown, of course, all this made possible by his decision not to run. But this week, he made his maiden appearance as a Fox News contributor. Here he is speaking to Sean Hannity.
To do 5 races in 6 years and raise another $30 to $50 million and then go and participate in a Congress that's really dysfunctional and extremely partisan, I felt I could make a difference being on this show and doing other things. And, you know, I'm going to continue to work and be part of the election process back home and other elections throughout the country.
So on Fox News, Sarah Palin is out. Scott Brown is in. John, what do you make of the former senator's career move?
I don't know what those other things are going to be, but but they better be something, because being on Sean Hannity's show isn't going to change much of anything. And Scott Brown is going to be in an interesting position. He's going to be trying to thread the needle to be controversial enough and outspoken enough for Fox News to earn his pay, and yet still remain viable if he wants to get back into politics. So he doesn't want to shut that avenue off necessarily. Fox News is projectile punditry, you know? I mean, that's what they do. So whether he actually fits in there or not, we'll see.
Dante, what does it say about the possibility that he might run for governor down the road? What would it do to his chances? Does being associated with Fox News hurt him?
It's funny. Fox News has become for Republicans what the Kennedy School of Government is for Democrats. You know, it's a place where you lose your election and you need a place to kind of sit back and contemplate your options. And that's sure what it sounded like, at least in his debut. I didn't think, others may beg to differ, I didn't think that he sounded much different in what he told Sean Hannity. You know, he's talking about a dysfunctional Congress and, you know, the difficulty of getting stuff done in Washington. He didn't sound much different from how he sounded on the campaign trail. You know, I think it's true that being on Fox News and being on camera, you know, he's almost bound to get pulled in a direction that, you know, he ends up saying something that is really inconvenient for running for office in Massachusetts. But, you know, he may, as time goes by, realize that maybe running for office again in Massachusetts isn't so hot an option to begin with, because, you know, he's been a national political celebrity. And it's hard to replicate the circumstances that got him elected to the Senate to begin with. But it's also for him to step back and run for some other office, you know, maybe shy of governor, like an auditor or a legislative office. You know, that ends up being kind of a come down. So, you know, it's not like there's a really great office for him to run for. So, you know, maybe Fox News is the best option.
Interesting. Well, one more bit detail before we move on, just about Scott Brown and our poll here at WBUR. He still remains hugely popular in the state, according to the poll. 58% of those polled viewed him favorably, puts him well ahead of any other one running for the Senate right now. 62% of those polled said that he should run for office again in the future. So clearly some capital to run on in the future, if he should so choose to do.
It'd be interesting to see what being on Fox for 2 years would, what effect that might have, if any, on that political capital here in Massachusetts. But anyway, let's move on, if we can, to the surprising, even bizarre twist in the case against reputed mobster James Whitey Bulger. Now, Bulger, of course, is charged with multiple murders and will go on trial in federal court in June. His defense is based on the claim that the FBI granted him immunity back in the 1970s. But this week, Bulger's attorney, J.W. Carney, offers this stunning statement outside the federal courthouse.
James Bulger was never an informant to the FBI or anybody else at any time.
Stunned silence from the crowd, except our own David Boeri, WBR senior reporter, asks J.W. Carney, is it true that Bulger wasn't an FBI informant? Then how could he have been granted immunity for crimes that he allegedly committed? So here's how Carney responded.
We're going to present that answer when the trial starts on June 10. If you want to know what the answer is, be there.
Puffs of smoke. Boom. He walks away. There it is. But seriously, Dante, let's start with you. I mean, this is a major trial. It involves all sorts of levels of the federal government, a dark period in Boston's history. I mean, what do you make of J.W. Carney's, I don't know what to say, the cynical part of me wants to say, working of the media here this week?
I don't know why you would call that the cynical interpretation. It sounds spot on to me. It was a tremendous act of showmanship, if nothing else, on his part. I mean, he doesn't have a great hand to play, to mix metaphors here. He, you know, there's a lot of stuff on the public record from other trials and legal proceedings and so forth about the relationship between Whitey Bulger and the FBI. And, you know, there's, you know, based on the evidence, it seems like there's a pretty good chance that some of the charges against Whitey Bulger are going to stick. So there's no, you know, what's the worst thing that can happen at this point, that Bulger will, you know, be convicted and see some prison time? I mean, there's every incentive for Whitey's lawyer to create a circus atmosphere just because it introduces some uncertainty into the proceedings. And, you know, certainly, you know, as my colleagues Kevin Cullen and Shelley Murphy said yesterday on your show, you know, Whitey wants to salvage his reputation,
right,
as somebody who was never an informant. And, you know, this plays into that, too. Both of the arrows point in the same direction.
John?
Yeah, well, it's the aptly named J.W. Carney because it's like a carnival sideshow. But that's what you get when you buy his services. I mean, you know, that's exactly what Whitey needs. He needs some kind of sleight of hand. He needs some kind of a sideshow diversion to basically occupy the media, occupy people. You know, they're writing about this, so they're not writing about necessarily revisiting the murders that he's allegedly committed. So I think that this is a smokescreen in a way, but it's probably a useful smokescreen because the more doubt he can create, remember, he only needs one juror. The more doubt he can create, the better.
You know, you mentioned, Dante, that Kevin Cullen and Shelley Murphy, they've written a new book about Whitey Bulger, and that, yes, they were on the show yesterday. And, you know, one thing that I came away with after that conversation was the reminder that, you know, the sideshow aspects of the pretrial shenanigans from lawyers aside, I mean, this is a major Boston trial about a really dark period in the city's history, and a lot's going to come out again for people who may not remember it or have lived it the first time around. So I'm wondering what you make of that aspect of, Bulger's day in court, which is coming in June.
Right. It has the potential to be either something that provides source material for a Dennis Lehane novel or a Ben Affleck movie, or it becomes a window for a city that actually has changed quite a bit since the heyday of Whitey Bulger to look back at some of the history that keeps, that keeps kind of kicking the city in the behind. I think that for the average Bostonian, the Whitey Bulger experience is something that is sort of foreign to their experience, and it's a historical lesson, but it's not a reflection of the city in its present condition.
Right, John?
Yeah, I think it's going to be a wild media show for sure, and they don't come along all that often. This is going to be a real pylon in terms of people trying to one up each other, people trying to come up with something that is that it'll go viral, that is buzzable, that is whatever you're looking for with your news media, and so I think the excesses of the media are going to be the thing that I'm going to be looking for, because I think it's going to be hard for people to restrain themselves in terms of the competition that's out there. There's a lot of competition, and a lot of it is unsupervised. There's a lot of internet sources that are going to have less than adult supervision, and I think that's going to be problematic in some ways.
So let's finally talk very quickly about the big storm of 2013. This week began with a city close to paralyzed, with up to 2 feet of snow across the state. Tens of thousands of people were without power. Schools remain closed through Tuesday. And Mayor Thomas Menino expressed frustration with his own city's snow removal process. Let's listen.
You're taking too long. And I want to make sure the next time we have a snowstorm in the city of Boston, it doesn't take that long. I'm a very critical person when it comes to snow removal, and I made my departments hear about it. I expect more out of them.
So what do you think, Dante? I'm going to go out on a limb and say, come on, it's February. There was a lot of snow. those snowplow operators are working hard. Do you think the city could have done a better job confronting Mother Nature?
I think there are always ways. You know, every big storm becomes a learning experience, and there probably was a way. I think that one of the specific issues that came up was the balance between plowing major arteries and plowing side streets, mm-hmm. and the balance seemed to be in one direction toward major arteries. And, you know, you can make an argument for that. Probably the mayor is hearing from people who would have wanted to, you know, have their own streets plowed. But, you know, I think I've been surprised, I guess, in terms of the public reaction that I've heard, that it seems as though people more or less have been willing to cut the city some slack. And I think there aren't many people who feel like if there's 2 feet of snow that fall on Boston, that there's not going to be some inconvenience.
Yeah. What do you think, John?
Well, we've entered the tire slashing portion of our snow cycle, so I think that's very encouraging. You know the five stages of snowstorms, right? There's snow angels, and then there's anger that is not gone, officials' denial of preferential treatment, tire slashing, and then more snow. So you know, I think that's good. I think it's interesting to watch the progression of Tom Menino as the revisionist history gets rolled out, you know, because in the early times, he's apologizing to the city citizens of Boston. The next thing you know, he's on the Today Show saying what a great job he did. So that's pretty predictable, I think.
All right. Well, we'll leave it there, and more snow headed our way over the weekend. So let's move on to our hubbub, that story that fell below the fold this week. John, let's start with your hubbub.
My hubbub is that both local dailies now have waded into the branded content waters. Each one of them has a sort of a sponsored site. The Globe has the Insights blogs listing, which is sporadic in its disclosure that these are actually advertisements. The Herald just started a site, State of the Arts, which is right now on a barter a system, according to the Herald officials. But basically, they're looking for branded content, too. So these are ads in blogs clothing that both local dailies are starting to produce. And I think it's a wave that's just going to keep getting bigger and bigger as we go along.
Interesting. Dante Ramos, your hubbub.
I will decline comment on that last subject. My hubbub,
I know you're not working on them, Dante.
My hubbub looks back to the 1980s and the 1990s, which was a time when Boston had a vibrant musical and cultural underground scene. One key site for it was over in Cambridge, the nightclub Man Ray in Central Square. Mm. In its heyday, it was a haven for gays and goths and fans of new wave synth pop, and had kind of an outrageous reputation. But the important thing about it was that it showed that Boston was a big enough and open enough and tolerant enough place that it could accommodate all kinds of people, and that lots of different types of people could find a niche. Inevitably, as housing prices and land values soared in Cambridge, the site ended up being redeveloped as housing. Man Ray closed in 2005 and has been looking for a new site ever since. But finally, it's time to dig out that old Depeche Mode T-shirt. because this week, the Cambridge License Commission approved a new site for Man Ray on Mass Ave. So they'll be back this fall, proving that Cambridge and Central Square today aren't just drug companies and luxury condos.
All right. So here's my hubbub. Red Sox president and CEO Larry Lucchino finally admitted, I don't know if it's admit is the right word, but he said that the sellout streak will end this season. And I'm truly shocked, as if finishing last in their division last season wasn't bad enough. Here comes another slap on the face. But the sellout streak is going to end at 793 games, according to Lucchino. But here's the thing. A lot of people have had doubts about that sellout record for a long, long time, given all those empty seats that have been visible to anyone who went into Fenway. So why admit now that this is about to end? Well, Lucchino made the curious case that now the Red Sox are underdogs with $180 million a year payroll, one of the highest in baseball. I don't know if underdogs is the right word, maybe underachievers. But, hey, it's springtime in Florida. The Sox are underdogs. The sellout streak is dead, or a dead myth anyway. But I'm still looking forward to seeing them play in April. So that's just an expression of what a sick person I am, I guess.
Plenty of seats still available. Come on down to the ballpark.
Yeah, Magna, let's go to your hubbub.
Here it is.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
I like it.
Okay, So this is my hubbub. It's been percolating for a couple weeks now, but it comes courtesy of the Phoenix, because they picked up on the fact that Joyce Linehan has convinced Representative Marty Walsh to file legislation to make this song, Roadrunner by the Modern Lovells, the official rock song of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. Now, before you laugh too hard, Massachusetts already has an official state song, All Hail to Massachusetts, a state folk song, Arlo Guthrie's Massachusetts. Of course, we also have a state bird, a state insect, a state cookie, and an official muffin. So why not a rock song that makes you celebrate 128? That's my question for today. That's my hubbub. I think we should go out on this music.
All right.
There is no answer to that question, by the way.
We'll leave it hanging there. John Carroll, communications professor at Boston University, and Dante Ramos, deputy editorial page editor for the Boston Globe. Thank you both. Have great weekends, both of you.
You too. Thanks.
Thank you. You too.
And still ahead on the program, there's a new sheriff in town, Elizabeth Warren, the longtime Wall Street critic, demands tougher action from the nation's bank regulators. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. We'll be right back.